From last Friday, we began discussion on the 14th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, this wonderful scripture which brings the ultimate goal of mankind within the grasp of everyone if we follow the proper procedure. It gives the proper procedure and also the principles that underline the procedure. The procedure is important if we want to actually practically implement it. It was told in the 13th chapter that it is the one reality, one being, the divine, that dwells in everyone. And in that one, everything is dissolved. That one is the existence. Now, it is, and it was described that that is the goal. That is what one must know and realize. And knowing that, one attains the supreme in life. Without it, the life is just barren. It is only a frustrating struggle all the time. It is a hellish existence in unreal, existence in this imaginary world. It is very difficult. So when you realize the truth, you get the ultimate. Now comes the question of how one goes about it. It is true that one by a little pondering can feel that this multiplicity is not real, one is the truth. I intellectually understand it, and I feel also the bondage under which I am being suppressed. It is true that the life here as I see it is full of suffering and with promises of pleasure. The check of pleasure is only always in the mail. It never reaches us. It is this kind of existence we experience here. But how then one goes about in becoming free? Where is the knot of that bondage? How can I untie it? How can I know that where from this bondage comes to me? And how do I then think of that nature, my true nature, which is beyond bondage? I don't see the connection between the two. It is all right that intellectually I understand that there is in truth oneness, all-pervading oneness. And if I make that assumption, then the question still remains as to how the one becomes so many. It is, if it is one, let it remain one all the time. Why? What is the need for it to become many? This question gets asked in so many different forms, that why did God create this universe? And while creating, did he not have enough brains not to put suffering in it? While making the world, he should have followed proper recipe. Instead of cooking the world with too much of suffering in it, the God should have eliminated suffering from it and could have put all happiness. But as we see, the world is full of injustice, suffering, problems, tensions. No day goes without we feeling some sort of these negative ideas around us, that there is injustice going on, there is suffering coming to me. How, why should it happen? It is difficult, well nigh impossible to answer these questions. Swami Vivekananda said, probably I would have done a better job had that job, had that been entrusted to me. Probably I would have made a better world. In fact, in our imagination, we always try to make the world better, by eliminating this or eliminating that. But we soon discover that still the problem doesn't get solved. One of the devotees coming to Sri Ramakrishna answered this question, that why there is so much suffering in the world, saying that, well, the day that God had his decision made that suffering should be put in the world, I was not invited for that meeting, so I cannot really tell why God decided to put so much suffering in the world. The idea, although put in somewhat humorous way, the idea is that we have our existence started in this state, and so what happened previous to that, we have no way of knowing it. So that is the idea, that we were not invited for the meeting. We came in this world after everything is all done, and now therefore we cannot know the cause, because it was much before that the things happened, so we have no way to know about it. So therefore these questions come, and sometimes they, or not only sometimes, necessarily they impede our practical development towards the spiritual life. That what is the use of this? This is bondage is there, but is there a way to get freedom? How all these questions will get answered? One gentleman, a very learned professor, when he was thinking about or talking about these, he said that, okay, it's fine, but what is the use? Nobody can overcome this bondage. Those stories that somebody overcame this bondage, somebody became free, I don't find any person in life around me who has done that. Do you know anybody? And he asked me, do you know anybody? I said, well, okay, if I tell you that I know, even if I give you the name of that person, what criterion will you apply to test it? Do you have a criterion to test it, whether he has gone beyond the bondage? How will you know? And then he agreed immediately. That's an issue again. Suppose I tell you yes, come on, Jitendra, here sitting, he has realized the truth and gone beyond bondage. How am I to test it? Do I have a yardstick by which I can test it? That is again a problem. So therefore, this question makes many people just shun this spiritual life. What is there? It is all lot of talk, and so the questions just remain as evergreen as they were in the beginning. So therefore, no point in trying to become spiritual or read the scriptures. They are all full of contradictions and confusion. At one place they say that it is all one, and then they start discussing about the many. They start discussing about the aspirations and the spiritual practice. We have these questions many times. That in fact in this class they had been asked a few times that if I am really Brahman and divine, what is the need for any spiritual practice? Just think that I am Brahman. And that is all. Why is there a need for any spiritual practice? Okay, do you know this? That becomes the question. Do you really know this every moment of time, every moment of your life? Can you think that you are Brahman? Then there is no question. So therefore, to convert this some kind of an hazy understanding about the reality into a practical experience which is tangible, and with that tangible experience the problems can be really overcome. So this 14th chapter therefore begins with that. What is the nature of this bondage? How it functions? What are the different ropes by which you get bound? That needs to be discussed, that needs to be told. And so Lord started discussing this, that and uses the familiar descriptions, things which are familiar to human beings, that how the creation takes place in this world, how things get born. So the analogy of human birth is used for that, to explain it, that well, there is the mother and father, there is the ovum and sperm, and thus a child gets born. So this universe also got born like that, that there is a big ovum, and then Lord put the seed in it. Lord says there very importantly that there is no separation though. So he says it very clearly in the third verse of this 14th chapter, that that matrix also is mine, and I am also the one who put the seed. There are not two. It is just two aspects that you see of the divine. There are no two there. It is here that Vedanta categorically differs from Samkhya philosophy, where these two are shown to be distinct levels of reality. The reality called Prakriti or Pradhan, or in English it gets translated differently as the nature or matter or the matrix, that is shown to be separate completely from the consciousness. So the consciousness is considered to be separate from this matter, and these two combine to make everything in the world. Everything in the world is combination of matter and the spirit or the soul or consciousness. Here we see it. Everything that you can even think of, even at the thought level, even at the dream level, it is matter, and then you become conscious of it. So that is how you see that it is matter. So consciousness is involved in everything. It is an inscrutable combination of matter as well as the consciousness. So you cannot separate it. The problem is, can you show that this is matter and this is spirit? Because as soon as you show, it becomes a combination. It is not possible to separately show that. So therefore, the Sankhyas developed this big theory, very beautiful philosophy. But Vedanta says that it is not right. You cannot show any distinctions actually. And moreover, the human craving for oneness is so profound that as long as there is the feel of duality, it goes on working to remove that. The feeling of oneness is very deep in us. So therefore, we see that whether we can intellectually explain it or not, we are always conscious of the oneness and are in fact looking to experience it. So we see that unless we reach oneness, the questions can never be really answered. So therefore, when you reach oneness, then there is no question that could be asked. Who is there to ask the question? There is no two, so there is no questioner and the one who will be answering it. So then all questions are stopped, all these doubts are resolved. So this is what Lord says, that it is my nature. Remember that it is my nature. It is in which I put the seed, and through that combination of this nature and seed, you see the creation spreading. Everything then becomes separate, individual. Although we cannot fix the boundary line of each individual, the doubt comes because of this, that we see that things are separate, but when we try to decide that where that separateness is and try to exactly put the boundary around it, then we see that it is not possible, it is not that. Like say George, and we see George here, it is George is separate from Girish sitting in front of him. But where George begins and where George ends, it is very difficult to exactly determine whether George ends at his skin, or whether at his cloak, or whether at his coat or jacket. You cannot tell whether his nails are part of his or not. You cannot tell. It is therefore very confusing, that where a person begins and where a person ends, You cannot draw the precise boundary lines, and that creates a doubt that if they are different, can you specify where exactly they are different? You may say that, well, he has a brighter or the fairer skin, A has fairer skin, B has darker skin. So that is the difference. But then the skin color can change. And you will not be able to then show that as a criterion that distinguishes them. So you can have a skin transplant, and so all the color will look alike, or the skin color does change. So therefore, that cannot be really given as the distinguishing feature. What can you tell? This person has long hair, that person has short hair. Well, the hair can be cut, can grow, and so forth. So you cannot even tell that. Anything that you try to tell that this is the distinguishing feature, it can be shown that that distinguishing feature is subject to change, and therefore it is not really that by which you can cite the differentiation. So this gives rise to a lot of confusion. And oneness, the real absolute one in which all distinctions get dissolved, that is the answer to it. And moreover, that is the goal of human beings, as well as he had told in the earlier verse, that by realizing this truth, one attains the supreme. One attains the supreme goal of life as one gets this knowledge. And it had been explained also that how that is the supreme goal. The supreme goal, because there is nothing that you can think of after that. The total fulfillment comes in one's life by just having this knowledge. And we saw that how it happens, because this happens because we are already perfect, because we are actually Brahman. And the ignorance that I am such and such little being, when that gets removed, you become that. It is many examples are given to illustrate this, that for example, that somebody is missing the reading glasses. It happens because when you are talking to some person, while you are reading, you need them. And then if suddenly somebody comes to talk to you, and then you just push it on your forehead. And then after a little while, you feel that, well, they are gone, they are lost, I am not seeing them anywhere. You ask people around, look in every drawer, and then somebody points out, hey, right here. Now, what happened there? Just the knowledge came that it was always with you. You had never really lost it. Only it was that knowledge dawned that it is with you. So similarly, our divine nature was really never lost. And by being divine, what does it mean? That you are perfect. You don't lack anything. You don't have any desire. You are limitless. So that knowledge comes, and thus there is nothing further to be achieved. So it is told now that now see how this bondage comes to us in the practical life. In so many ways we get entangled. Really, we do not have a proper understanding of this. Till we try to break free. When we try to break free, then we know that by how many different things we are bound and to what extent. Just by trying to break free, we start seeing that even many little things, they seem to bind us. And how do they come? Where from do they arise? So, It is described here as a way of making us understand. The understanding is always given according to the capability, the nature, constitution of the student. As human beings, we have a certain way of understanding. Certain things which are familiar to us, when analogy is presented on those lines, then we understand it. So, here it is shown that our mind works in three different directions or three different ways. And these three different ways are kind of constituents in everything that we see. Technically, and they are called gunas. It is a word that is not again very easy to translate in English. Here therefore, it is left without putting any other translatory word into it. That the fifth verse, Sattvam rajastama iti gunaha prakriti sambhavaha nibadnanti mahabaho dehe dehinamavyayam. Sattva, rajas and tamas, these gunas, O mighty I am one, that are born of nature, prakriti, bind fast the immutable embodied being in this body. The immutable being gets bound in a body. That we all feel, we are as to our true nature immutable, but feel that immutable thing as if bound in a body. Where am I? The body and I, they are tied together, so to say. So I say, yes, now I am giving a lecture at the Vedanta Society in Providence. I am in Providence. But am I really in Providence? Am I limited by this? The body is there. Is mind too there? It may not be. Mind may be in some other place, or it can be at many places simultaneously. Mind may be in one place. Am I really my mind? Need not be. The mind is another instrument that I am using, just as body is my instrument. Mind too is my instrument. I told you a few funny incidents that took place here, like a car. You identify a person that with the car. Car is because that person always uses that car. Once I got a call, this person, it was about John, whom you most of you know, that is John here. And then I said, her car is not here, probably she is not here, she must have gone somewhere. But then she was right here, and somebody had taken her car. So the car was not here, but she was right here. So it is a confusion. So we can understand that that confusion can happen. So our body is like a vehicle, a car. The car may not be there, but the person could be there, or car could be there. Even had I seen the car and said, yes, her car is there, she is here. No, the car could be here, and she might have taken a flight and gone somewhere else. So just by seeing her car, you cannot say that the person is there. So, our body is really not the sign that we are that. So, this is why we feel the bondage, and therefore the craving for freedom is there too. That we are all pervading, now crammed in a little body. 5 feet, 2 inches or whatever height. In that, the infinite, limitless self is crammed. So, how much bondage, you see? If you are put in a that dungeon room. Okay, you are imprisoned in this dungeon, 6 feet by 8 feet. Then you feel constricted to such a small place. Now body is still smaller than that. So how much bondage we must be suffering because of that. So we are avyaya, means immutable. There is no change in it. I am the same, but the body keeps on continuously changing. It is the name of all these changes that is called a body. In fact, its nature is to change. So this immutable being is imprisoned in this changing case of body and mind. And how is this bondage? There are these three types of walls in it. Sattva. That again is an analogy in terms of how we feel it. Our feelings, our understanding has these three ways. That in everything, including our own actions and our own awareness, we can see sometimes we feel very calm, poised, enthusiastic, but without any turbulence. There is the respect, love for wisdom, knowledge, understanding, love. We are kind of in our right senses, we feel. There is the automatic idea of benevolence, forgiveness. We don't then consider anybody's faults much. Okay, things happen like that. This automatic spirit of forgiveness is there. The spirit of benevolence is there. Kindness is there. Serenity is there. All of us experience it sometimes or other. Some people more, some people less. So that is what is the characteristic of what is called here sattva. Then there is the other tendency, desire spring up. I am sitting calm, peaceful, and then there is no disturbance. But suddenly a desire arises. Hey, I must go to see that nice African safari. And as the desire comes, it brings about a disturbance and dynamism and an imbalance. I feel the sense of dissatisfaction of being just in our Rhode Island. Of course, Rhode Islanders generally don't feel that kind of dissatisfaction. They don't go out much. It is. I was told that maximum limit is they go to Newport within Rhode Island. From Providence to Newport is a fairly long journey. So it is. But then even to go to Newport, well, you have to take up that journey. That dynamism springs up. You think, you feel dissatisfied with the present state, and then as you, if you are working, you start how to manage my vacation. If I have to go to Africa, I will require, say, at least 2 weeks, and then how to get the tickets, how to arrange money for that, and so forth. All these things start coming up, and the activity proceeds. And then that activity, there are impediments in that. The desires that we have, no desire is without any impediment, without any obstacle. So you have to overcome those obstacles. So there is an enmity that ensues with it, conflict ensues. So that is all the sign of rajas that brings anger in life. It brings some kind of a hatred and feeling of enmity, and that whatever brings obstacle, that automatically becomes enemy. So therefore the enemies are not permanent, you know. It is stretched sometimes to a longer extent than the obstacle remains because of the memory that, well, this person was an obstacle. And so although that person may not be an obstacle right now, but the memory that sometimes that person had been an obstacle makes me even now feel that that person is an enemy. In politics you see this all the time, that sometimes when we had some common interest, then we had alliance with Russia. United States and Russia, they were together fighting the Germans and Japanese in the Second World War. But then after that the friends became enemies, then again the enemies become friends, so forth. It goes on because our purpose, when there is a common purpose, then we join forces. When it is opposite to each other, we become enemies. So it is therefore important. You can actually listen from that room also, you know. You can see and listen from that room too. So that is what is called rajas. The rajas is this, that desires spring up, activities come up, disturbance comes, and it is physical as well as mental. At all levels we see that disturbance coming up. So that is one aspect. The third aspect that is described here is tamas, and we all get that from time to time, that feeling of laziness, indolence, just the feeling of irritation, nothing directed against, nothing particular, but that thing comes if sometimes we would be talking very nicely, very politely, answering somebody's question, but in some mood, if somebody asks you a very simple thing, you may, one just replies, "Hey, why are you asking me?" It is that irritation comes up. Now, what is the, it is expression of what? The ideas of hatred, the ideas that of that criminal attitudes, they all start coming in. They for nothing you would like to quarrel, pick up quarrel for nothing, just for the sake of having some quarrel. So therefore we see that this third is called tamas. It is not a directed activity at all. There is no direction to the activity. It doesn't bring any result, and it is just a clogged up state in which you do not see the any particular light there. So that is called tamas, which literally means darkness. There is the darkness in life. The truth or the sense of who am I and the purpose, everything is fully lost there. So that is the state of called tamas. So it is told that these three together, they are prakriti sambhava, they are born of this nature or the prakriti. This matter has these three aspects of functioning to make it clear that they are not touching your true nature. Your true reality is untouched. It doesn't come from the divine, but comes from the prakriti. So That is the expression of matter that we see, that it has these three contents, three levels or three types of contents, sattva, rajas, tamas, and they are in everything. So this is how you get bound, these three cords, three chains that bind us. It is not because of the technicality involved, it is not very easy always to appreciate and understand this for people who are not trained in that line or have not studied much of this philosophy. But Sri Ramakrishna used to explain it through a story very nicely, that how this sattva, rajas, tamas is. All three are bondages. And in that sense, for a spiritual aspirant, all three are enemies. So he used to tell the story of a man in just walking in a forest, got caught by three robbers. Three robbers took hold of this person and then bound him, and then they took away all the possessions that this person had. Then one of them said that, what is the point in keeping this fellow alive now? Let us kill this fellow. The other said, No, why should we kill this person? Let this person, we have done our work, we have gotten all money. We will keep this person bound here, so that now we can take to heels. Later on, maybe somebody will see and free this person, or he himself may be able to get away, and we don't need to kill him. The third didn't say anything at that time. When all three then left this fellow bound, this third person comes back, releases this person from the bondage, and then tells that, okay, you know, you are in this forest now, let me show you the way to go back to your village. So he accompanies him up to the where from the village could be seen, and tells, okay, that's your village, now you can go. And this man felt very overwhelmed by the kindness shown by this third robber, and he requests him, hey, you are so kind, you did such wonderful favor to me, now I feel, please come with me. I will be so happy if you come to my home, and then I would like to offer you some hospitality. I will be so indebted to you if you just come to my house. This third robber says, oh no, up to this point. After all, I am a robber. If I get there, I will get caught. I will not go that far. I have just shown you the way. Now you go yourself. I cannot go there. So Sri Ramakrishna used to tell that story and said that, look, the three robbers are these three gunas. The robber that, and all three snatch the money. That's true. What is the meaning of this money here? Our freedom, our intrinsic divinity, our true Satchidananda nature, the existence, consciousness, bliss that we are, that has been taken away. We are robbed of that, and all three equally participated in robbing that. Now, the one who wanted to kill was a cruel fellow. Really, there was no purpose further for killing this person, but this person is of that type, impulsive, and cruel, doesn't have any sensitivity. So this person is tamasic, no sensitivity. When we see people having, you know, we behave many times ourselves, when we, at least I have found myself doing it many times, that later on it dawns upon me that I should have shown more sensitivity here for the problem of somebody else. It is, we are not always very sensitive. So that is again an aspect of this tamoguna, this tamas, that this robber was not sensitive to what, why kill this person, but he was bent upon that. Then the second said, well, no, don't kill. Let us make our escape, forget about this person, killing is not right. So this person was a little better, although this person did not free this traveler. The second was therefore rajas, that it took the booty, it kept the bondage, but did not kill. The third is the sattva who frees, but it does not bring you to your home. It does not lead you actually directly, it doesn't accompany you till your home, means your true nature. You have to leave that also behind. So this sattva also is to be left behind, but it is the best guide. You have to take up sattva as guide, and through that guide you can then see up to where your village is, where your true nature is, what is the purpose of your life. All that you can see in the light of this sattva guna. So sattva is to be nurtured, cultured, developed as a spiritual aspirant, the one who will be able to at least break this imminent bondage. These ropes at least will be cut, and then this sattva that will show me the path. So this is these three things are of this nature: sattva, rajas, tamas. So the description comes as we go ahead. Tatra sattvam nirmalatva prakasham kamanamayam sukha sangena badnati jnana sangena janadha. First, the nature of sattva is being described. Of these, sattva, on account of its stainlessness, is luminous and free from evil. It binds the embodied self by attachment to happiness and by attachment to knowledge. O sinless one! Very beautiful description. Really, these descriptions in Bhagavad Gita are unparalleled. I didn't find any other book in which such details of this functioning of the sattva, rajas, tamas are being given. So it says, how is this sattva? Nirmalatva prakashakam anamayam. Prakashakam anamayam. And how, why? Prakashakam means luminous and free from evil. And why? Because of its stainlessness, nirmalatvat. One feels the sense of purity. And all of us at some time or other feel a sense of purity. And then at that time what happens? The light shines up in life. We feel this. Sometimes we get an understanding comes of who am I really. Temporary, but at least some light gets shed on it. One feels that the knowledge dawns there, light dawns there. We feel that all the sense organs, so to say, they are not craving for anything. They are really only illuminating. Our sense organs, you can see that they function also accordingly. When there is the sattva predominant, then eyes see. They do not crave. The eyes, you can see the two types of functions. Eyes with craving and eyes just seeing. So, sattva brings only knowledge. So, you see that luminosity. You can judge things more objectively because the craving has been removed from there. And how does it bind? This brings, because of the sattva, it has less thicker covering on our blissful nature. The thickness is less. So transparency is more. So you feel more happiness. Happiness is an inner quality, friends. Happiness, feeling happiness doesn't depend actually on how many possessions that you have. One may feel, yes, I feel happy when I get a lot to eat. No, not necessarily. One may get lot to eat and yet may not feel very happy. You may feel that I am happy when I listen to this music. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. And the same music may not always bring about the same happiness. So, it is a state of mind and it depends on reducing this covering, making that covering less opaque, more transparent, and that is the quality of sattva. So, happiness is brought in life by this sattva. You automatically and spontaneously start feeling the inner happiness. The source of all joy, one starts feeling, and that is why sattva brings happiness and then attachment to that happiness. And that is where the bondage comes, a very subtle bondage that ensues from this sattva, that bondage to happiness and bondage to knowledge, both. And they are bondages. Today the time is finished. We may be able to see next Friday that how the sattva creates this bondage due to happiness and due to knowledge. We think that happiness and knowledge, well, they are liberating forces, yes, in one sense, that's true. But also they have another component, that is bondage and this consequent suffering, and that comes because of these two here. So we shall try to see that next Friday. Any questions today? Yes, please.
You said we cannot give an everlasting definition for the finite object and things, but for functional purposes, it is okay for us to give
a... Yes, that is
or
true.
Or is there an example that we still have confusion even in the functional purposes?
The functional purposes, it is the function lasts longer than the separation lasts. That is the problem. And that is why the conflict comes. The separation is the separation, for example, that I gave, that the color. Now, the function is that it is functionally good to identify these two, that is the function, and it works. But the function of identification has to remain longer, and the color may not remain that long. So that is how we see that on the IDs, how people cheat on it. The ID means something that has to remain for quite some time. Your driving license, for example, should work as an ID for so many years. Now, within that year, suppose that person does the facial, that plastic surgery, and changes the face. So the appearance will be completely different. Somebody will have an appearance exactly like me by changing it and then pass for me. So, although the function is served to some extent, it doesn't get served for a longer time. There is no limit how long will it serve. Again, we cannot even pinpoint that it is only for this time that the function will get served, because there is no definite these parameters by which the changes happen. It is therefore very difficult, like the uncertainty that is a part of this, and this uncertainty, how much is the uncertainty? When Heisenberg was telling about it, that how much is the uncertainty? If we can tell exactly how much will be the uncertainty, then that is again a certainty, not an uncertainty. So he said it cannot be actually told. You can say only this much, that it will be minimum this much. It will be minimum, he had given a figure, that it will be minimum that much uncertainty that will have to remain. But you cannot say that it will be that much. It is going to be usually much more. How much uncertainty, you cannot tell. So that is why it serves the purpose to some extent, and therefore it should be used for that. But bearing this in mind, that we are using it only at this relative functional level, and it should not be stretched beyond that. And this awareness is lost many times, that this distinction should not be stretched beyond it. So let us conclude with the closing prayers. Gita Sugita Kartavya Kimanyat Shastra Vistarayi Yatvayam Padmanabhasya Mukha Padmadvinesrita Ekam Shastram Devaki Putra Gitam Eko Devo Devaki Putra Eva Eko Mantra Tasya Namani Ani Karmapyekam Tasya Devasya Seva Shri Krishna Arpanamastu.